You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day, go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm not.
Analytics don't work at all. It's just a crap to some people who were really smart made up to try to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a baller. He's a playmaker and a shot caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bone. He shattered the mold and all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown 538, the podcast about the week in sports narratives. I am Chadwick Matlin, so happy to be back in the studio, editor at 538. With me, the full crew, Kate Fagan, yeah. ESPNW columnist. Hey, Kate.
Hi, Chad.
How are you?
I'm good. I'm really happy to see you.
Thanks. Happy to see you, too. I watched so much Indian cricket. More Indian cricket than American baseball.
Is that what we're calling the Mets now?
Yeah, they, you know, so many runs and innings and overs and wickets and
unders,
whatever else. Yeah.
How was India, though?
It was fantastic. What a strange, fascinating, interesting place to be for two weeks. But I was sitting... We should say hi to Neil Payne, of course. Oh, Neil Payne, yeah. Sports writer.
I'm sitting right here, you guys.
So I was listening to the Mets games when I could... on the equivalent of 56K Wi-Fi on my phone, it going in and out. I couldn't get
crackling.
Any video. Apparently, Chase Utley did a bad thing, but I...
He was a scoundrel, according to Nate Silver.
Yeah, you have been gone a long time.
So I missed a lot.
I didn't
that
see it. I only heard about it, yeah. And it was this very surreal sort of technological relationship with the Mets where I was only listening, and it was through some miracle that I was listening at all, and yet it still felt... pretty far away. It was a very strange experience I had. Anyway, Neil, hi. How
hey,
are you?
Chad.
Great. Good. Guys, we're going to do an all World Series podcast today.
Yay.
That means no concussion watch. We'll get back to concussion watch next week, which I think we've been remiss in doing several weeks on. But we're going to talk about Daniel Murphy, who has embodied so many cliched metaphors. I've lost track. Human torch, wrecking ball, steamroller, what else?
Roy Hobbs.
Roy. So we're going to talk Murphy. We're going to talk about how both these teams have defied the odds over and over again and what we're supposed to make of that. Is there such a thing as a team of destiny? Or is every team just an outlier in the end? And then finally, ardent Royals fan and 538 managing editor David Firestone will come into the studio and tell us why the Royals are going to lose. And I, ardent Mets fan... and General Neurotic is going to tell him why he's wrong and why the Mets are going to lose. Stay tuned to the end of the show for that. You guys ready for full baseball? All baseball all the time?
Let's do it.
How are you feeling, Kate?
Never go full baseball.
Six straight games with a homer, an OPS of 1462, steals a third when nobody is looking. He's responsible for 25% of the Mets' postseason runs. He's the inspiration for one of the takes in our theme song. Daniel Murphy is having the best month of his life. Here's Good Morning America's TJ Holmes on the legend of Murphy.
If you would have gone to the Wikipedia page for Daniel Murphy last night, his name was officially changed to Mr. October, but he was also called God. His middle name was Jesus. He was a Supreme Court justice, and he was also called the owner of the Chicago Cubs.
The Honorable God Jesus Murphy. Comma,
Cubs
owner of the Cubs owner, right. Guys, should we be in awe as we are of Mr. Murphy?
I don't even want to hear what comes next or look at the numbers any further. I just want to be in awe.
You're feeling good about the awe.
Yeah, I'm feeling good about the awe. It's like this is a fun Mets movie to watch. I don't want to go on Rotten Tomatoes. I don't want to see what the smart critics have to say. It's just like a little piece of magic.
He's already an Oscar winner in your heart.
That's right.
You might want to go on Fandango, but...
So, Neil, at the site, we've been writing about Murphy. Our baseball columnist, Rob Arthur, has been writing about whether or not we should be surprised. I'm going to read a bunch of numbers in a second. But for you, stat man himself, as you've been watching Danny Murphy, like what goes through your brain as the most sabermetrics-y of the three of us? do you see the sport for the raw drama that it is when things like this happen, or are you just thinking about regression to the mean over and over and over again?
No, I tend not to watch October baseball as being kind of statistically driven. I like to watch it for the drama and for the narratives and for the crazy things that happen. Like, you know, I think with Murphy, yeah, you would go into each of those plate appearances and each of those games and be like, he's a career, whatever, OPS hitter. Not a good but not great career hitter. So the odds were that he would regress to the mean and that the hot streak would end. But I'm not rooting for it to end. I'm like, I want to see more of this. It's fun to see a guy hit home runs in six straight games and do what he's done. So, I mean, I think that's what October baseball is all about. And I think a lot of people that I follow on Twitter and, you know, people that I think would have been hardliners maybe 10 years ago, they would read Fire Joe Morgan and they would, you know, correct all of the sports hot takers and say, oh, you know, postseason baseball means nothing and it's all random and all of those like angry stat nerd takes that I think emerged about a decade ago. I think now everyone has kind of mellowed out and it's just been like accepting October baseball for what it is, which is it doesn't prove anything. It's not a scientific experiment designed to give you the best team in baseball. It's just supposed to be fun. And baseball actually becomes, you know, after this long sort of grind of the season in which it's very easy to let all of the tiny moves sort of wash over you. Even if you're watching the same team on a night-by-night basis, the long game is what people have in mind. In these games, every game is managed like you were coaching the Super Bowl, to kind of mix a metaphor with football. Like these small things that we do chalk up to randomness during 162 games of the regular season suddenly they take center stage and they become more than just, oh, a random, you know, variance happening on the field.
It does seem like we've seen an evolution of how stat heads, sabermetrics, like respond to the postseason or respond to the notion that, look, you can't name everything. You can't have a number to name everything. It's like, even though in another one of our hot takes in our intro is Charles Barkley saying, like, yeah, taking a shot at it, there does seem to be a kind of confirmation that it's a part of the game and it serves a valuable role. But it's like everybody's okay now, including those with ownership in sabermetrics, to say now, look, let's just watch playoff baseball in a way where we can just be fans again for a minute.
So, but then what do we do when Danny Murphy God and Jesus? Because, okay, so some numbers now. So he is 692 points better in his postseason OPS than he was during the season. That's basically a whole extra Danny Murphy that Danny Murphy has
crammed
in.
I love his Danny Murphy that we're going with.
Oh, is that not what? That's
adorable.
What I call
him. Is that what they call him in India?
My plush doll that I hug when I go to sleep of Danny Murphy, yeah. And so if you randomly pick any nine games, which is how many games he's played in the postseason, for Murphy's 2015 season, this is according to Rob Arthur, the odds that you'd grab a stretch containing this good of a Danny Murphy, right, this much OPS, is 4 in 10,000 odds. That's an infinitesimal percent. That's 0.04%, right? Maybe less than that. I can't do it off the top of my head. But the point is that this is a random, crazy event that we're seeing. And so to sort of anoint him God and Jesus and whatever else feels like we're buying into these kind of narratives that we at Hot Takedown often want to push against and take down.
Well, I don't think so. I mean, I think being in awe of something that happened is different from saying that it'll happen again or that, you know, Murphy intrinsically has this ability. I don't think anyone is seriously saying that he is like the reincarnation of Babe Ruth and think that that is suddenly like who he is as a ball player now. But I think that, you know, there are various degrees of acceptance of the hot hand, for instance, where some people probably do think that he has raised his ability level over what he's displayed over the past few years and that some of what we're seeing is real. And some people and I would probably be more in the camp of these people think that it is more of just like he has gotten hot at the right time and is having the best nine-game stretch of his life.
So there's more than just being hot at the right time. It's that he's gotten hot for the right team. So Rob Arthur in his piece also wrote about that Murphy isn't even the player this postseason who's most overachieving compared to what we would expect from his regular season. The Cubs' Jorge Soler has been even better than the Jorge Soler we knew, but he's sitting at home. And so like part of it is the stakes and the impact and the effect of the production.
Well, and part of it is that Danny Murphy went from like good.
I prefer Dan.
I like Daniel. Went from like pretty good to like outstanding, which to me is a more impressive jump to a baseball fan watching than another player going from like mediocre to pretty good in the postseason, if that's fair to say of Soler.
He also went from pretty good. He had a better OPS than Danny
Murphy. They pretty much were at the same level, I guess, as players like going into the playoffs. So it is kind of more improbable for Soler. But I think
that's my point about narrative, though. It's like these things. I've enjoyed the Danny Murphy saga more than anybody. And
from the foothills of the Himalayas.
Yeah, exactly. And it has been. I've really had to wrestle with the saber, as you guys were talking about, with the sabermetrics nature of my job and what we talk about here is like, is this actually adding anything to the conversation for me? In some ways, yes, it's telling me how unlikely the incredible story that I'm taking in is. But then you talk about the Soler thing, and then also Rob pointed out, of all the players in a postseason, there's a 50% chance that some player is going to get this hot compared to their normal self. And that waters it down a little bit, you know? So, like, what's the role that these numbers are playing?
Well, I don't know. That's every other postseason, there's a player who has this kind of streak. So if you are a specific fan of the Mets, that means that, I don't even know how to do the math on that. Every other time, when your team's in the postseason.
Which is rare.
And then in a team that's going to the World Series, like, so I don't know how to do that math, but it feels like it is a once-in-a-generation performance by your team's player in the postseason. Neil, you might want to help me out a little bit on how those numbers would play out for each specific team.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, once you're in the playoffs, having a player play like Murphy is going to increase your odds of going to the World Series, just because he's been so great. But yeah, for it to happen to a specific team that you are rooting for is really rare, and for it to happen, I think it probably doesn't increase the odds of making the World Series as much as you would want it to. Like with Soler, it didn't really help the Cubs make it to the World Series because, you know, in addition to him cooling off in the NLCS, a lot of his teammates also played below their standards. So I think it's a matter of like, a lot of times we think of these as like kind of competing hot and cold streaks. And you can even see that with the Mets where like as hot as Murphy was, Lucas Duda was not necessarily having the best postseason until maybe the last game of the NLCS. So, and David Wright too. So, you see like, if you can balance out your hot streaks with guys that are not like in super cold streaks to offset it, then that's sort of almost like how you go deep in the playoffs in baseball. And we really haven't figured out a way to kind of engineer that to happen as much as it just is something that like it happens. You know, it's going to happen to some guys will be hot, some will be cold. You just roll the dice and hope for the best.
Yeah. But I think to your larger point about like, does it add anything? For me, to see like the framework of whether what he's doing is once in a generation or not, or to have all those numbers, I don't know. I don't really need all of that because there are certain things that are happening with Daniel Murphy and with the Mets that just supersede and transcend anything that you can tell me nuts and bolts wise. Like, I wouldn't feel any differently about the Mets right now if the numbers pointed out that this was the first time in Major League Baseball history this had happened. It wouldn't matter to me.
Right. For me, it's been difficult because I think I actually care about these games, right? I care about the Mets, and I care about what happens in the chaos and the randomness and whatever else. And I think what we do on the show and what we do at 538 and in general with stats, we're looking at things pretty objectively and from the outside and talking about leagues as a whole or trends as a whole or whatever else. And it's often that we aren't really involved in them in any way. And the moment I've found that I'm really involved in a high-stakes venture with my team, I just don't – it doesn't matter to me, these numbers. And that's been a real, like, foundational shape. Like, I feel like – my sabermetrics interest has been shaken by that a little bit, which is like what it's one thing to talk about it when you don't care, but if this thing that you do care about, which is sabermetrics in my case, doesn't apply when I do care about this other thing, like that feels like an incongruity that I can't quite square the circle of.
Just compartmentalize, Chad.
Yeah, right. Maybe I'm thinking about this too much, basically.
Yeah, I mean, like I had to pick either the Royals or the Mets to win the series on around the horn today and like pored over the numbers, right? They're like, Mets throw fastballs 95 mile per hour on 38% of their, you know, their three aces. And but the Royals hit 284. It just felt like all I had to do was like, because I'm a Mets fan and rooting for them, mm-hmm. like I wanted the numbers to mean what I wanted them to mean.
Right. There's a it's almost liberating, right? It's like if the numbers are this, in this case, this even in many ways, or you mm-hmm. can make the narrative both ways about the numbers, mm-hmm. then it just means you get to watch the games and have fun, basically.
Yeah.
Okay, let's move on. A similar related conversation.
Take one step to a different Mets topic.
Well, no, to the Royals and the Mets, but the Royals too. So the Royals were down 6-2 in the seventh inning of an elimination game in the ALDS. They had a 1.6% chance of winning the game and a less than 1% chance of winning the pennant in that moment. They came back to win that game 4 against the Rangers. They won the series. They obviously won the series against the Blue Jays as well in the ALCS. The Mets, meanwhile, had a 20% chance of making the playoffs in early July and seemed to be one Danny Murphy game away from losing to Zach Greinke and the Dodgers in the NLDS. So my question is, what are we to make of these improbable runs that both of the teams have taken, it seems, to get to the World Series? The traditional way to talk about it is to mention a team's drive or the will to win. Here, for example, is Ned Yost after the Royals won the ALCS.
Last year at this time, we were so excited to be here. This year, from the first day of spring training, we expected to be here. You know, our players, they had such a great season. They would never quit. They continued the battle, even when the chips were down a little bit.
So, help me out. Help me be a good empiricist, basically. So, when you look at this, and this is the case for all sports, whatever teams end up in the finals, it just seems so crazy and outlandish oftentimes that they're there. So, like, how am I supposed to think about this as a good empiricist?
Well, I don't think that there is such a thing as a team of destiny. I'll just put it right out there because it's silly. Like, a team of destiny would imply that some team had a 100% chance of winning beforehand. And
such a destiny absolutist,
it
Neil.
Just does, but it doesn't make sense. Right. Like, you know, some two teams are going to meet in the World Series, and when once you know which two teams that those are, you can look back at their season, and especially in the playoffs, and you can pick out moments where perhaps it seemed like they weren't going to make it, and they, you know, had an amazing, unlikely comeback or whatever, and you can say it seems like destiny, but if you replayed the season again, the odds are that it wouldn't even be the same two teams. And then whichever those two teams were, you could kind of go back with that knowledge and pick out moments from their season too. So I think it's like it's a really silly concept. I know why we do it. And I think it also speaks to kind of that tug of war between empiricism and fandom almost, where you feel like you need to justify the investment that you make a lot in these teams, the emotional investment, the time investment. If a lot of it does come down to randomness, I think one of our instincts is to sort of feel like we've wasted our time or like, what's the point? And so to kind of combat that, we need to have these narratives, almost like a spiritual narrative surrounding a team where, oh, they were a team of destiny. So instead of investing in something that either worked out or didn't, but it was based on coin flips or rolls of the dice, I invested in it and I was rewarded. It really is like a religious narrative in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I was going to say when you mentioned the destiny piece that there must have been a 100% destined outcome. Well, that then leads us to believe that there was some sort of destiny god that decided that outcome
right,
should be in place.
Right, who decides what is the team of destiny beforehand?
Right, and that then
and could they just, what if they tanked? What if the Sixers were the team of destiny and they you know, tanked the whole season, but they still won, you guys, because they're the team of destiny? It's
so
stupid.
The Daily News has decided the Mets are the team of destiny,
of
for
course
example.
They
but
have.
I know, of course, I'm saying, but like, to your point, Neil, I mean, this is a word that is thrown around all the time in sports.
Like dynasty.
I'd like to think less so now than in the past, but go on.
Oh, so I disagree. I feel like the conversation around greatness is just as inflated and fatalistic.
Grandiose.
As it was before. And I was trying to think about the closest in the discussion of this. Sorry, while this podcast has been going on, the closest we've come to a true team of destiny that we talked about, and maybe it's the Golden State Warriors who were favored from, I'm not saying they were a team of destiny, but I'm saying like it seemed as though they were going to win
And then they did.
Right, and then they did, right? But still, you know, percentage-wise, I'm sure, Neil, you had done some projection.
Well, and or you could say the Kentucky in the NCAA tournament seemed to be...
They seemed like a team of destiny,
I mean, they won that
sure.
one... They pulled out that one game and, like... In the round of
like a miracle
Elite Eight,
yeah.
where they like their chances for winning were like 1%. It was Michigan State, I think, against Michigan State.
Yeah, maybe.
So, but I loved what you said about the fact that we reject notions of randomness just as human beings. It's like if we're being told, if I'm being told as a Mets fan, and Chad's being told, and now Neil as a Mets fan as well, like
I'm rooting for them.
You're like, this is completely random. Your Mets, there's nothing like human sort of these stories we tell ourselves that have created this moment for you. It is simply this random outcome that if we played the season 1,000 times, maybe the Mets would win, you know, 60 of them. And that's all this is. It's the same idea like that, okay, the world is just like nothing, right? I mean, I'm sorry to get like too deep, right?
That's
but we,
deep
no, we create stuff, stories to make sure that that's not the reality. So I've created a story that it's Wilmer Flores, like the night he was traded, that like changed everything, that turned the Mets into
right.
like his tears were almost like an offering to the destiny gods, right?
Right, that's right.
Like I've told myself
averting
this story
the Gomez
because
trade, Cespedes comes in, it all I mean it's a great narrative. It's a fantastic
so
narrative.
So yeah, because if you told me it was random and we're evolutionary and we're just black to black, I can't deal with it.
So but what's interesting is it seems as though what I'm hearing is that it's reminding me of the conversation around soulmates when you date someone or something like that, right?
Right.
Like, depending on your feelings about commitment and about the spectrum of sexuality, whatever else, like, you may or may not be ending up with somebody no matter what. And the question is, the route that you take there, was it some... So to make sense of it, right? Because to make sense of meeting someone and falling in love and whatever else, and I feel like I've fallen in love with the Mets, obviously, in my life. And to make sense of that and to make sense that they're in the World Series or to make sense that I'm engaged or whatever else is a crazy thing. And it's bigger. It's too big for our brains to handle. And so we fall back on these narratives, but they feel really good. Like if the Mets win the World Series, I'm going to think that something was special about this team. And I don't have to think about it within a religious sense, obviously, or within a fatalistic sense, but maybe something was special. And it might just be that Danny Murphy hit six home runs in six straight games and stole a third base when no one was looking.
And I think, I guess it's very special to the fans of the team that ends up winning. So I don't think it takes anything away from the experience, and it probably adds a great deal to actually believe that, you know, in these narratives about destiny or what have you. I think the problem comes in when you start, like if there was someone in charge of building the team, for instance, that started thinking in those terms mm-hmm. and didn't actually kind of take this clear-eyed sort of like...
But we heard Ned Yost say that they expected to be there, right? And there was almost a causality that was
you
implied.
Have to expect to be there if you're a Major League Baseball player or team, right? Like, I mean, if you have aspirations to win a championship... That self-belief is almost like a necessary requirement to be here at the end of the season, I think.
Right. It's kind of like with writing. You can't just wait to be inspired. You've got to like sit down and do the hard work. And then retroactively, you can tell the story about how you were inspired and then like you wrote by the ocean. And but you're like these teams have to do the work. This is where this analogy comes. These teams have to do the work, lay the groundwork, make the right decisions. And then if we want to retrofit some kind of team of destiny narrative like the Royals are trying to do and like Mets fans are trying to do, well, then that's part of the game. But that doesn't mean that they could just like put anybody out there and show up and win.
Right.
Because like 2015 was the Mets year. And if you played it 1,000 times, they were going to win 1,000 times.
And how many teams have we seen that were almost like prematurely anointed? And will to keep it on the Mets angle, think about the Washington Nationals, who seemed like a team of destiny, at least during the offseason last year when they added all of these pieces. And that totally disintegrated, but you can bet that if they didn't disintegrate the way they did and they were here at the end of the season, then you would have that narrative about how, you know, they went out and they got all this great talent. And the Warriors are interesting that you brought it up, Chad, because there's almost like a weird counter-destiny narrative that's been going on. I forget which player it was, but someone said during training camp that they were lucky. There's almost like a debate that has been sparked over the last month or so about how they were lucky because they didn't have to face the Spurs. They didn't have to face you know, some of the other juggernaut teams that they could have gone through. And that is it's like your the destiny that you take on yourself is being almost negated by your opponents, who say that it wasn't destiny. They use luck as a almost like a weapon against your championship to try to devalue it.
And there's nothing the Warriors can do, because we can't go play 2014 and have them face the Spurs, and then, you know, Durant doesn't
get hurt.
And they
beat the teams that beat those teams.
Right, so it's kind of like, how can they even defend themselves against that statement? Because we can't go back and make them take the hardest road to the finals, so they have nothing, they can't say anything to that.
I'm realizing that argument is sort of a companion to the nobody believes in us argument, which is that nobody thinks we're destined. You know, like, nobody thinks that we are destined to win, and so therefore we are destined to win. Like, no matter what, we're trying to fill these holes to motivate, or athletes are trying to fill the holes to motivate in some way. And I would think, and Kate, maybe you can speak to this, it would be really difficult to be an athlete who believed in total randomness and chaos, because it's like, how do you get up for that? Just thinking, like, right, I can do the best I can to prepare myself, you know, to execute on the highest level, but in the end, I don't have as much control over a situation as it seems.
And it feels like we're getting occasionally a little heavy in, like, God and, like, destiny talk, but to add to that, like, heaviness, like, we tell ourselves stories in order to live is like a Joan Didion quote, which is applicable to almost every walk of life and sports as well. I mean, no athlete's going to get motivated by the clear-cut numbers or just staring at a spreadsheet about how they might win. They're going to be motivated by a story that someone told them about why they aren't supposed to win, or why they are supposed to win, or their history as a player and why they became great. I mean, although, all that is motivation.
I love the idea of, like, a team in the huddle kind of, like, putting their hands in and be like, let's weight this random number generator slightly in our favor on three.
Arian Foster, known atheist.
I know.
For the season. Coincidence? Causality?
God's retribution.
Okay, guys, let's leave it there. I will say the anxiety level in this studio is about to skyrocket. Because a Mets fan and a Royals fan is about to say why their teams suck and are not going to win the World Series. And so I think you guys should take shelter while I talk to David Firestone.
Okay. Head for the hills, Kate.
Okay, bye. Let's go.
But you'll be back for Sig Dig.
If you really need us.
We can't do it.
If there's anything
you.
Left in the
right.
studio.
Yeah. Can't do that. It's just a hollowed out bomb shelter. All right, Neil and Kate have fled with me in the studio. 538's David Firestone. David, prove your Royals bona fides to the listeners. How far back does your misery go?
The very beginning, 1969, when they replaced the Kansas City Athletics. We were there, and I followed them in days of triumph and many, many days of failure ever since.
So you are a Kansas City native?
Yes.
And how strange has it been to watch them be good after all these years of being bad?
It's an out-of-body experience. I'm sure you know that sense, and we'll talk about the comparative sense of the tradition of despair that we share. But I can't believe that it's happening. I didn't think it would happen 1 year, let alone two years back-to-back. It's amazing.
So I brought you here so that both of us can unburden ourselves on one another as good neurotic baseball fans. We cannot help but think our team is somehow going to blow it in some big moment. There's no bigger moment or bigger stage than the World Series. So I figured we'd get together and share three reasons why my Mets and your Royals are going to flame out. Do you want me to start?
Please do.
Okay. So the biggest thing that I have been struggling to get my head around is the Mets fastballs versus the Royals contact rate. And the sabermetrics types have been really interested in this because the Mets dominated the Cubs, and one of the reasons was because the Cubs could not make any contact with the Mets fastballs. Ed Grantland, Ben Lindbergh, and Jonah Carey wrote this World Series preview that was quite good, and they noted that of 779 Mets pitches this postseason, 511, which is 65.6%, have left the hand with a velocity of at least 95 miles an hour, which sounds terrifying, except the Royals are really good at hitting that. Their weighted on base average, WOBA, which longtime listeners will remember from a stat school on Hot Takedown, goes up as the balls get faster, which is so it seems to me like there's a strength for strength thing here, and what I fear is that the Mets young guns are just going to get contact rated to death, that the balls are going to go into the infield and then chaos takes over.
The Cubs I think had a a pretty high strikeout rate compared to other postseason teams. And the Royals have the best contact rate. It's something about their eye. It's something about their sense of judgment. And they also are great at picking up on cues from pitchers. And there was a great SI story the other day about how they started to figure out Price's moves. And, you know, I don't know exactly what it is. It's a combination of aggressiveness and judgment, but I think that's probably the biggest thing that Mets fans should fear at this point.
Okay. Terror number two. And I am in full irrational hot take zone here. I am convinced that Jacob deGrom is secretly just toast. That we just have... He has had two starts in a row now in which he has been on the razor edge of just totally falling apart. Terry Collins left him in too long, in my opinion. He let him go through a third time in the order when he looked gassed from the moment he stepped out. When you look at his the line drive rate on his pitches on Brooks Baseball, his sliders are getting hit for higher line drive rates than they have all season. He's giving up more fly balls than he has all season in October. He has a higher whiff rate, but as we said, when the Royals make contact, I'm worried that his pitches aren't moving the same way, and the numbers sort of back it up if you look in the right cynical way.
Maybe you could make a case that he's a good five-inning pitcher and not a seven- or eight-inning pitcher. But one of the problems, and maybe you're going to get to this, is that the bullpen, with one exception, the Mets, isn't nearly as strong as the Royals, and so they wind up leaving pitchers in way too long. I really don't understand that philosophy, having come from kind of the Royals' background recently, of leaving these very young starting pitchers, and as strong as they are, as controlled as they are, they're just getting weary, it looks to me.
Yeah, the bullpen's not even on my list, and so if we went right to four places, certainly it would have been. To me, the Mets bullpen has been mediocre more or less all year long, and so I know it's a known quantity. You know, in my terror dreams, it's not something that I can't make sense of, the way that I can't make sense of whether contact rate is going to trump fastballs or whether DeGrom is just secretly done. But the bullpen is, I agree, not good. Okay, number three, Danny Murphy.
Mm-hmm.
He just can't keep doing this. Right. He can't keep doing this. So we dwelled on this in the podcast earlier before you were here. But what does this Mets team look like without Daniel Murphy in the middle? We know that they probably would have lost Game 5 against the Dodgers. We also know that the Mets are super streaky. Lucas Duda has disappeared. Maybe he's come back. He's easily going to disappear again in the World Series. Cespedes can look glorious while flailing all around the strike zone. D'Arnaud can disappear. Wright has disappeared. I just see a middle of this order that falls in on itself, especially if Murphy regresses even remotely to the mean. And even though the Royals pitchers are nothing to sniff at, their starters at least, I see just total ineptitude, the way that I saw the Mets be inept against the Yankees late in the season, against the Phillies when home field advantage was on the line. And this gets at the stuff that just feels totally random, that the Mets could just stop hitting.
Every New York team, it seems to me, because of the poetic needs of the local sports writers, needs a narrative. And clearly the narrative, and this, we have to leave the realm of stats here, the narrative is Murphy. And without him, the fable of this year's Mets, it seems to me, kind of falls apart to some degree. I mean, obviously they've got a lot of other strengths, but he's the one everyone's talking about. And I think I have a feeling that the Royals have, you know, paid for some serious scouting there, are figuring out exactly how to get to that guy, because the one thing they have to destroy is this notion of the narrative that he is some kind of a miraculous symbol of the Mets' resurgence, and they're going to try and do everything to take that down.
I don't even think they need to scout him that hard. I think just pitching him. I mean,
right.
The guy's a 275 hitter, and he's hitting out of his mind. Okay, so those are my anxieties. Do I dare hear yours? Do you think your anxiety stacks up?
Absolutely.
All right.
So, by the way, we have a lot of shared sense of failure here that is prompting this. So in my case, it's kind of the opposite of yours. I have a lot of confidence in our bullpen. Starting pitching is going to be a big problem. These guys are erratic. And as much as we like to imagine otherwise, they have failed. And those of us who have watched the entire season have seen many, many outings where Volquez, Ventura, et cetera, have just gone out there and given miserable performances. And half of it seems, or maybe more than half, psychological, that somehow you're able to get to them, that if you call time in the box, if you step out of the box, you can and infuriate them, it'll throw them off for an inning or two. And with Cueto, for example, who really is the symbol of erraticism on this starting rotation, all you have to do is get him in an out-of-town park and start yelling at him.
He seems that fragile to Royals fans?
They started yelling Cueto, Cueto in Toronto, and it clearly got to him. That's one of the reasons why he's pitching in Game 2 and not at Citi Field.
Yeah. And so it seems also like this is not the case where Cueto's ERA is inflated. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but his sabermetric stats are also not promising. And right. There's been lots of talk about whether he has an injury that's secret and that they're going to reveal at the end of the season. But so as a Mets fan, I think, too, the starters are a joke. And the Mets have four – in each game, basically, you could argue that they have the better starter,
right.
Depending on your feelings on Chris Young and Steve Matz. And so to me, that feels like a real opportunity to avoid the Royals bullpen as a whole. And right. You're saying that you're feeling that too.
Absolutely. Okay. It's the secret fear, actually not so secret, of every Kansas City fan this year.
Okay. Number two.
Two, and this is a mixed bag, of course, is the corollary to that, and that's Ned Yost and his tendency to stick with these starters too long. Ultimately, all of us have to bow down to his judgment because for all the crazy criticism he gets, he is generally proven right. And no one knows why.
So this is where you and I differ. Getting something right is different than being proven right, in the sense that he's making the wrong decisions over and over again that happen to come out okay, but that doesn't mean that he was right. It means he was wrong and got bailed out to me.
That's right. And, you know, you saw that the other night. Time after time, there have been moments he left in Ryan Madsen too long and Bautista hit that home run. You know, but in many of the games where he has made bad decisions like that, some miracle happens. In this case, Lorenzo Cain running from first that suddenly bails him out and he looks great. However, a lot of fans point out that he's also the one who put together a terrific scouting team. He is the one who ultimately made possible a coaching staff that got Lorenzo Cain in from first by windmilling him in. So, you know, for every crazy decision he makes, and it's usually sticking too long with a starter, there's a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff that I think has generally proven him correct. But nonetheless, he makes me very nervous.
In big moments, like
that's right.
Whether or not to leave Ventura in for another right. trip to the order. Okay.
The third one is completely irrational. And I talked to Neil about this before this this podcast, and he told me I was crazy. But I think a lot of American League fans, no matter what team they support, fear going into a National League park and having to kind of tear up their lineup. In our case, you know, Ken Morales, or as a star writer likes to call him, Big Ken Morales, is a huge part of their offense. He will not be able to play in the National League park, and you know, it just scares me. I just have a feeling that somehow this is going to throw everything off.
Why did Neil say that was irrational? Because to me, I also am rejoicing at the fact that I don't have to face right. Morales for three of the games.
So Neil's point is that National League teams also have a lot to fear because they have to really dig to find a designated hitter in the American League parks.
Right.
And sometimes they can't come up with one who equals the...
we're going to start Kelly Johnson on Tuesday night and he's
no
going
to... Ken Morales.
Right, exactly.
Right. So, you know, we've got four games at home, ideally not, but possibly, and the Mets have three. So arguably, maybe we've got the advantage, but nonetheless, it still scares me.
And our pitchers are better hitters than your pitchers are because they're used to hitting. And
that's right.
Famously, Syndergaard and Matz have had great offensive.
That's right. We do have a few pitchers who've been in the National League, but nonetheless, they have no recent experience with that. And it does keep me up a little bit at night.
Okay, so David, both of us are beside ourselves coming into tonight's game. Have you thought about whether the Royals are going to win, or is that not even on your mind? Because to even approach that, despite all these anxieties, is to curse them or somehow jinx them. I am in full, we just spoke about this on the podcast, in full irrational mode about the Mets. I'm feeling buffeted by the winds of destiny and the history of total ineptitude. And I don't know whether I'm feeling sort of good, I must say, despite all those anxieties, given the starting pitching. But the moment I feel, I let myself feel that is the moment I realize I'm just setting myself up for total pain.
Right. Well, part of it is after what Royals fans went through last year, those final moments of the final game.
Send Alex Gordon.
That's right. Which, by the way, would have been a bad move. Sorry, Nate. You know, there's nothing that really can bother us at this point. I mean, there's no fate anymore. There's no sense.
If you're in game seven again, you're not going to feel upset if they lose.
The great thing about it was, we were all incredibly proud of the Royals last year. It was a great season and a great series. This year has been even better. To have enjoyed this much baseball, to see this many games, and especially, by the way, that last completely hair-raising, soul-wringing game of
Game six,
and to have gotten through that, just to be in the World Series at this point, to have a pretty strong shot. I still think it's going to be the Royals in seven. But if it isn't, I just feel completely zen about this at this point because we've already been through the worst
so
that can happen.
Grace, David. I have none of that grace. I will be. I once thought when the Mets were so bad in mid-July that the postseason was such a – like a winning season would have been enough. And I've become so greedy. The moment that I have you only get so many shots at the World Series, at the postseason in general, especially in baseball where things can be so random, come the postseason. And I cannot imagine – I will not be calm. I will not be graceful. If they lose, I might not show up to work the next day, David. You might have to give me an excused absence.
That's right.
All right, David, thanks for coming in, and we'll have to watch and see if our anxieties come true.
It's going to be a great week.
Excellent. Thanks. All right, I promised it was an all-baseball podcast, but Allison McCann is here to liberate us and give us a little spice in our life. Allison, welcome back to the show, as always.
Hey, Chad. Thanks for having me.
So every week you come, you bring us our significant digit, a telling number from the world of sports. What do you have this week?
This is a particularly meaningful, significant digit to me. It is 184, which is the greatest number of international goals scored by the one and only Abby Wambach, who is retiring. She announced today that December 16th will be her last game with the U.S. Women's National Team. And she remains far ahead of the pack with her 184 international goals. So cheers to you, Abby.
Yeah.
Will she keep playing in club soccer?
No.
She didn't play last year.
Okay.
Yeah.
So how long is she going to be the best ever, do we think? Like, is this such a titanic achievement?
Well, who's in second? How much?
Well, it was Mia, and now obviously Mia's retired, so.
Christine Sinclair, the Canadian forward, is at 155, but she's probably also on her way out. She'll probably have another Olympics in her, but she's also quite a bit older.
Wait, is Christine above Mia?
No, she's behind Mia, but only three behind Mia. Yeah.
So it's possible that we've witnessed like the greatest female soccer career that we're going to see for the next generation or two, right? I mean, it seems to me like there's no obvious
and
candidate.
Male.
Right.
The males are like down in the 100. The greatest goal scorer, I think, is like at 100, which probably speaks to other things, not just
not just Abby's greatness, but also like the difference between the programs.
My favorite are that like the stats about like her head has scored 77 international goals, which is still like better than like
the highest scoring body part on record.
And I'll add that like there's a lot of athletes who have careers where the numbers seem to astound you, but they don't have any moments where you can like really remember where you were. And Kobe comes to mind there, right? Like, not to take a Kobe shot, but like, I don't have a Kobe moment. And a lot of athletes, right? You just don't have moments. But with Abby, like, she like delivered moments. And you don't practice just to deliver moments. And sometimes you have no control over it. I'm sure Neil would be like, look, well, you have a 2% chance of having like a moment in your career. But with her, like, that 2011 goal, like, it didn't matter. I'm glad they got the World Cup, and I'm glad Abby got the World Cup. But it almost didn't matter what she did after that because she, like, single-headedly
nice.
Like, kind of resurrected the U.S. Women's National Team. And obviously Rapinoe kicked the ball to her, and there's a lot of other people around. But, like, that moment, I remember walking through the airport and, like, watching my phone. And there's not a ton of women's sports moments that get to, like, elevate to that level. Do you remember where you were?
Absolutely.
Where were you?
I was in Boston. That was the summer I was like playing still, and like we were like watching on a couch, and it was like so dire, and they were like, this was going to be the worst performance in the World Cup. They were about to go out in the quarterfinal. And like, I just remember the announcing was like so dire too. Like, this is it.
122nd minute or something.
Yeah.
Like?
But anyway, and it's, I don't know. It's, I really thought she was going to stay in here for the next Olympics, and it's, I don't know. I think it's nice when people feel this warmly about your retirement and like you kind of ended at a good time. Not to say that.
I think it's the right time for her.
Yeah.
I don't think she needed to play in 2016. She has all the medals. I think it was like one of those athletes who walks away, not early, but at the right moment without having to play again. And maybe we see, does she play at all? How's she playing? It's like, look, I'm out. Peace.
Right. And like we saw with like Landon Donovan, to take an example on the men's side, sometimes it can get like super awkward with yeah. some of these players if they hang around too long.
Totally. So, yeah, sig dig this week. Abby, the goat.
The goat.
The true goat.
Excellent. Thanks, Allison. All right, listeners, before we do the outro, I know you all listen in just to hear me rattle off those,
you're really good
those
at
final
this.
Credits. One little programming note. A few weeks ago, we told you about Varsity Letters, an event in New York that a bunch of 538 folks were taking part in, including Neil. While I heard it was fun, I was away in India, but Neil, it was a conversation about this, the Madden project that you and Walt Hickey have done that we've talked about a few times. You can find, we posted the audio on our website, 538.com. You can find it there if you'd like to hear Neil and Walt talk about.
And John Boyce and of John Breaking Boyce Madden.
From SB Nation. Absolutely. Right. Talk about how Madden ratings get made. So check that out. Okay. That will do it for this week's show. Thanks, as always, to Kate Fagan.
Thanks, Chad. Good to have you back.
Thanks. It was wonderful. It was
yeah,
nice. Vibrant.
Really nice.
I felt good.
Yeah.
Neil Payne, thanks to you too.
Welcome back, Chad.
Our podcast producer is Jody Abergan. Our video producer is Ryan Nantel. We get production assistance from Jordan Shulkin and Lois St. Jock. Our intern is Sarah Patterson. You can email us at podcasts@538.com. We would love to hear what you think about whether you are destined to send that email. Find us at SoundCloud, Stitcher, Downcast, all sorts of other apps. We're all on iTunes, of course, as well. Subscribe at itunes.com/538. Be sure to review and rate the show while you're there. It helps others discover the program. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. I'm Chadwick Matlin. Talk to you next time.